Cosmic Shed. Hello and welcome to the Cosmic Shed. I'm Andrew and Maddie and I are just back from the Blue Dot Festival at Jodrell Bank. It's a wonderful festival of music and science, with the science really embedded in it. It had some really interesting and fun conversations, and I'm going to bring some of those to you in this episode. Maddie will be joining us later on, but we begin as the festival began with the Blue Planet Live. It's a live show that I was involved in back in 2006 and 2008, and it was quite an emotional experience for me to see it again, because the man who I'd done the show with, Howard Rayner, is no longer with us. This piece of music meant an awful lot to Howard, and he loved all of George Fenton's work for the Blue Planet. I know he would have loved to have seen the Blue Planet performed in this wonderful setting, with the Lovell telescope to one side of the stage, with the Halle Orchestra performing George Fenton's wonderful score along to the BBC's fantastic footage from that landmark series.
I'm Anna Brigham. I'm a violinist and violist. I'm playing with the Halle Orchestra, and we're doing a screening of Blue Planet. We're playing along to from an hour and a half's worth of footage from the BBC's Blue Planet.
So that's Blue Planet 1.
The first one. Yeah. Yes. That's
so how does it work being a musician in this kind of thing? Because the audience turn up and they see this incredible show. But can you give us a little bit of insight into the behind the scenes? What happens? Do you have lots of rehearsals? Is it all very tight?
It's very tightly written. So normally with any sort of thing, when you're playing along to a film, because the conductor has done serious amounts of preparation, so they've got lots of time cues, so they know exactly where, you know, like when the whale's fin reaches the edge of the screen, then, you know, we have to be at this specific bar. So there's some kind of, you have to be quite on the ball as the orchestra, because sometimes the conductor will just suddenly go much faster to get you to the right place at the right time. But generally it's written so it's very, very prescriptive. And then there are some bits where you have an option to, you know, if you've maybe got a bit enthusiastic and got there a bit soon, you kind of hold one note for a while to make you in the right place. Yeah.
And is it so when you're actually performing it, are you really concentrating on the conductor? Is it yeah, more than a normal classical gig that you have to concentrate on?
It's a really different type of concentration, I suppose. It can't be quite as free and spontaneous as a normal classical show. But yeah, you definitely. I normally don't look at the conductor all the time.
He's not listening,
it's fine. If you're a conductor, I'm really sorry. But in this type of show, you have to be very much on the beat.
Okay.
It's difficult to concentrate. In the rehearsals, they had the screen so that we could see what was going on. Makes me play a lot worse because it's so beautiful. The footage is incredible. But I think, you know, in the actual gig, I won't be able to see what's going on, which is for the audience for the best.
So you're reliant completely on the conductor.
Completely on the conductor. Yeah. So if he messes up, then
yeah. It's nice that they let you see the footage in rehearsals, though.
Yeah, it was really nice.
Yeah, yeah.
I think it's so that it ensures that we don't turn around too much in the concert.
No. Awesome. So have you been involved in anything like this before?
Oh, I have, actually,
have you?
Yeah.
That's fine. Why don't you tell me about that?
All right, this is a really awesome project. This really awesome guy.
Oh, yeah, he sounds great. Who's he?
He's really good. He does podcasting now, actually.
Does he?
Yeah,
oh, he
yeah. He's
amazing.
Doing really well, actually. I've seen him for years.
So, yeah, full disclosure, we've met, right?
Yeah, we did Polar Explore, yeah. It was quite a similar thing, wasn't it? But just much smaller scales. It was just a string quartet. And it wasn't the original music to the show. So we kind of chose various things. So actually, to this day, whenever I hear one of the winter movements from the Four Seasons, I always think about penguins.
Oh, that's good.
Yeah.
I'm glad to know it's had a lasting effect.
It has had a lasting effect.
But, you know, so full disclosure, like, the reason why we did that is because back in 2006, 2008, I was involved in the Blue Planet Live as a And it changed my life, okay, because I did that because I wanted to bring people to live orchestral music, and now here I am as a science communicator, because that changed me. It made me go, okay, science is fascinating too. And I wonder whether there's going to be people in the audience still. I'm sure there are.
Oh, I really hope so. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, even in the run-through, there was just, like, you know, people, I think other people who are playing at the festival or people who are health setting up, they're kind of all sat on the ground and watch, and it's so nice, because often in classical concerts, you know, people aren't super engaged, but yeah. I think the blending of the two together is just, like, so powerful. You forget how powerful a live orchestra can be if you do it all the time.
Awesome. Now, you've done something else to do with physics.
I have.
Tell me about
Yes. My string quartet and I, with the help of a scientist, have written a lecture recital about Bach and the Art of Fugue, which was the very last thing that he wrote in his life. It's basically a whole series of pieces of music based on kind of a four-bar idea, and he's just really irritatingly clever. And we kind of explore it, but we also kind of break down how music works on a very fundamental level, in terms of, like, maths and a bit of physics, and I got a tattoo of it.
Really?
Yeah. This doesn't work on a podcast.
No, no, no.
But look.
Oh, wow.
So that's
I should take a photo. We'll have a photo, then we can...
Okay, yeah. So that's a visual representation of the harmonic series, which is what all music is based on.
Which is very helpful. Festivals?
Yeah, we did it in a science festival.
Which one?
Brighton Science Festival.
And have you tried to do it in other science festivals?
No.
Let's try and do it in some science festivals.
That'll be so good.
As I say, this was Blue Planet 1, and I know they're making the Blue Planet 2 into a live show. And that's TV series where, you remember, we had some of the producers and researchers here in the Cosmic Shed a few episodes back. It really had a huge impact in the way that we think about our plastic use. And one of the people we have to thank most for that is Dr. Lucy Quinn from the British Antarctic Survey. I met her at Blue Dot, and I asked her how she'd come to be involved in the Blue Planet 2 series.
I was working with British Antarctic Survey as seabird scientist down on Bird Island, which is one of the scientific research stations that British Antarctic Survey have. And it's a really small island. It's only 4.8 kilometres long by 800 metres wide, so it's tiny. And I was working there whenever the BBC Blue Planet team were wanting to come down and film a story about how older albatrosses put lots of energy into their kind of final breeding attempt, and it's something called terminal investment. So I was helping out with logistics of that, and just happened to be working on the island at the time. And effectively, whenever they came on, it was my job to make sure that they weren't, you know, getting too close to the birds, and that I was taking them to places where they'd be able to feasibly film the wandering albatross that they were wanting to film. And it was really through them being there that we then obviously wanted to show this story about albatrosses and the marine litter problem. So then I got involved with that story because I was on the island at the time.
Because people will have seen you on Blue Planet 2 on screen talking about this plastic problem. Incredible
heartbreaking footage, which has mobilised a nation and beyond, right? I mean, how does that feel?
It's been absolutely incredible. I mean, the thing with science quite a lot is, you know, it takes years. And I mean, people have been, you know, scientists have been working for decades knowing that there's marine litter problems. And in fact, at British Antarctic Survey, they've been looking at the plastic there for, over 20 years. To have, you know, the public react in such an incredible way to the story, I think it was due to, you know, the amazing images that the BBC Blue Planet were able to present to the public, combined with the fact that that final episode had, you know, scientists basically stating the case and you know, we're all collaboratively saying, you know, something needs to change because it's only us that can do something about this. And it's been amazing. So the public support has been fantastic. And I think it has ultimately, you know, forced our sort of government's hand at, right, yeah, we can't ignore this anymore. Something needs done, and it needs doing now. Otherwise, by 2050, we'll have more plastic in the sea than fish. And effectively, that's not a legacy you want to leave. I think the main thing is about ensuring that we stop putting plastic in the ocean. So that's that, you know, we need to cut off that. There's already lots in there, and that's going to disintegrate, and some of it may come out, but really, we need to stop at the source. Yeah.
So you're an ornithologist? What is it?
Yeah, marine ornithologist.
So, plastic is it something that the BBC saw because they were going to specific places, or is it everywhere?
Oh, it's everywhere. Yeah, it's absolutely everywhere. So obviously they were filming on many different parts of the ocean, from the deep ocean up to the surfaces and coastlines, and it has infiltrated everywhere. So, from the high Arctic down to Antarctica, and you know, from the smallest animal in the sea to the large whales, they're all being coming into contact with our own detritus and marine litter. I think it would just happen to be highlighted very well in the Blue Planet show, but it's something that, you know, if you've worked in marine ecology, it's been known about. So a seabird colony, you're constantly seeing how seabirds have brought back plastic to around their nests. I work on a project that looks at northern fulmars, which is a really lovely seabird that we have in the UK. And effectively, we get any fulmars that have been, say, washed up on the beach or caught accidentally by fishermen. We collect up all those samples and we dissect the fulmar. And over 95% of those birds have plastic in their stomachs, and that's in our own North Sea. And effectively, because birds forage so widely and go to so many different parts of the ocean, they're fantastic indicator species. So that's, you know, species that we can look at as showing us an indication of the marine health and where they've been to. And we see it in our everyday working. Now the question, obviously, as scientists, is how much of an influence is the plastic having on their population? And that's a big question. You know, we already know two of the main reasons why seabird populations are in decline, why certain populations are, for example, the albatrosses and some of our own seabirds like fulmars, is because they're being caught accidentally in longline fishing. So, tracking work has shown that there's overlap in the tuna fisheries, for example, in southern oceans. And so that's one major, major reason why lots of seabirds are dying, because they're being caught on fishing lines. And the second one, of course, is climate change affecting their food supply. And, you know, areas that they might have previously known, oh, this is a great foraging spot, I'm going to go there, they go there and the fish is either no longer there, it's been fished out, or, you know, that fish hasn't bloomed in time for them.
The albatross is it's almost a mythical creature. Most of us don't get to see them, but you actually get to hang out with them. Tell me why you love them.
Oh, goodness. Oh, where to stop? I think it's... they're incredible creatures to be around. They're very, very gentle, and well, they've got feistiness to them as well, of course. But they're just, I think it's to do with the fact that they're so long-lived. It's just amazing to think, you know, these some of these albatrosses can live till they're over 60 years old. And you just think of, you know, everything they've seen and the fact that they can travel for thousands and thousands of miles, you know, to get their food and come back. They're just so graceful when you watch them flying in the air. They're less graceful on land, you can just tell. And, you know, they've just such comedy moments as well. You know, if you just sit down and watch them, you can just see their lovely interactions with one another. You know, for example, in wintertime, the wandering albatross parents, they leave their chick over winter and they will just both be foraging for that chick, so they don't necessarily see each other as much as they will in the breeding period where they'll be swapping over. And so you can sit down and you're watching a particular nest for the chick, and it just happens that they will come in at the same time, and they'll actually spend time interacting and preening one another. And you know, they, you know, you don't want to anthropomorphize it, but you can see that they look pleased to see one another, and they beat clack and they preen before they even feed their chick. You know, the chick is crying about it, and it's so important to them. The pair bond is so important because ultimately they're interested in that long-term bond, and over and above the individual chick that's there. They're amazing creatures. And of course, you know, wandering albatross, they're 3.5-metre wingspan. It's amazing.
It's one of the things that you particularly you brought to this thing for me, is that you, when you see the albatross on film, you don't see it, you see it in flight, so it doesn't look that I mean, it's incredibly graceful. Doesn't look that different to a gull, right?
Yeah, of course.
Because
you
can't see the size, but when they're actually sitting next to you, or you're sitting next to them,
they're huge. Yeah, they're enormous. They're absolutely enormous. And when we attach, you know, we've been attaching very small GPS trackers to the backs, which eventually fall off, or we can collect back after a couple of weeks, to see where they're foraging. And to do that, you obviously need to be able to handle the bird and everything. And it's a real privilege to get to handle a bird like that. You know, you just can't get over. I'm used to working with, you know, with UK seabirds that are tiny. So I've actually, when I've come back to the UK now, I'm like, oh my goodness, this bird is so small. How am I supposed to capture this? Yeah. They're amazing.
Hanging out with puffins and stuff.
Yeah, puffins and fulmars and shags and
razorbills
and
pork.
No,
they're from Star Wars.
Little
the reason
pork,
that
yeah.
the porgs are in Star Wars is because the island that they were filming Star Wars on had so many puffins on it that they had to put porgs in it to cover up the puffins, otherwise they could tell.
That's amazing. I guess they didn't have puffins in Star Wars.
In a galaxy far, far away.
There's also puffins. Yeah.
Now, as I wandered around the festival, I found myself in a clearing among the trees of Jodrell Bank's beautiful arboretum. There, I found Macclesfield Astronomical Society with a host of solar telescopes, and I never pass up the opportunity to look at our nearest star in detail. In the eyepiece, I saw a black line on the disk of the sun. Paul Cannon explained.
Well, you've seen the dark filament in there on the top right. Did you actually see it?
I can, yeah. Yeah? Cloud clear.
Right, well, what that actually is a prominence. The prominences, if you like, are gas that's moving from one point to the other on the surface of the sun. But when they're actually within the disk of the sun, the dark, black... Right. When you're looking down on top of it, so it's a line on top. That's what you've actually seen. You're actually seeing a prominence.
Why would that be dark? It's
the light's not being emitted from it, if you think about it. It's been absorbed.
Okay.
All right? If you look at this here as well, this is, has in fact got a sunspot on there, which we can't see any at the moment on the sun. It's rather inactive. It's at a very low point. Yeah. Although there was one a few weeks ago I did notice. I think it's an 11-year cycle when it sort of drops down and climbs back up again. So we're at that low point. They call it the maunder minimum. Well, they think it might be, but they keep saying yes, no, yes, no. Yeah. They can't seem to make their mind up. I suppose when they get more evidence...
Yeah, you need more and more data, don't you? Yeah.
Okay. Whereas a flare is usually something which builds up and then comes off the sun. And some of those are the nasty things that come towards Earth. If one comes from this point, for example, this will reach Earth. And this is where we have very strange things could happen. I think it was in Canada and America a few years ago. There was a big blackout, and they thought that was caused by a solar flare, a large one.
So it can hit satellites.
Oh yeah, yeah, can take them out of action. And it can affect other things too, because we have a lot of sensitive equipment on Earth and in the sky, especially satellites anyway.
You're never more than a few steps away from a scientist at Blue Dot, and Professor Jim Wild is the Professor of Space Physics at Lancaster University. I caught up with him after his talk on space weather, and he picked up on this idea of the solar maximum and the solar minimum.
So the sun goes through an activity cycle. It's the magnetic activity that matters. And it takes about 11 years to go from one peak of activity to the next. And so in the middle, there is a dip in activity. So we call it solar minimum and solar maximum. And at the moment, the sun is magnetically relatively quiet. So it means generally there aren't very many spots on the surface of the sun. And there are fewer flares and eruptions from the solar surface. And these coronal mass ejections, these big explosions of material out into space are statistically less common at solar minimum. But you still get them. So space weather kind of is driven by these kind of effects. And so you always have to worry about it. But it's usually a bit more benign at solar minimum than solar maximum. And it's kind of like regular weather, you know, even in a British summer, even though statistically it's supposed to be drier and warmer, you still take an umbrella with you because you know you can have a rain shower. So these things are sort of seasonal and climatological, but space weather is really starting to look at when the sort of the short-term effects, when those pop out and then can actually give us headaches for here on Earth.
So what kind of headaches can they give us? What problems does it cause?
So space weather isn't anything new. So the sun's not changed that much in the last few million years. So really, space weather is becoming more of a topic of interest nowadays because as a society, we've built ourselves into situations where we're quite reliant on some technologies that are slightly vulnerable to effects in space. And so I'm thinking things like satellite communications, navigation, power grids and that sort of thing. And so those processes are, or rather those technologies are susceptible to space weather. So we really need to start paying a bit more attention to it. And so really it's just in the last 100 years or so that we've really started to think how space weather could influence our societies.
And is it only in space that these things can affect us? Well, if it was a strong enough solar flare, could it affect things right here on the planet's surface?
So in terms of life here on Earth, we're pretty safe. So we've evolved on a planet with a very strong magnetic field, and that magnetic field actually diverts most of the material streaming out from the sun, which we call the solar wind. It gets diverted around the planet by this magnetic field. So we live in what we call the magnetosphere. It's like a big magnetic bubble, and it's a force field, and we're protected by it. But that magnetic field also protects our atmosphere. So the atmosphere around the Earth is very thick and absorbs ultraviolet and X-ray radiation from the sun. It absorbs cosmic rays. So most of the nasty radiation that's coming from the space environment, our atmosphere shields us from. So it's kind of like a two-layer shield. We have a really thick protective atmosphere that protects us from radiation, but we also have a strong magnetic field which protects the atmosphere. So we've got this sort of multi-layered defense naturally evolved on our planet, which is kind of how you and I have become here, because it's been stable for long enough for life to evolve.
Good job it did, otherwise we wouldn't be having this conversation.
It's a very short podcast.
So, there astronauts have been into space. Two of them have been for a year, right? Everyone else is maximum 6 months. And some of them have been to the moon. How much did space weather affect them when they were there?
So, the effects of space weather in sort of simple terms gets more significant the further away you get from the Earth, because in low Earth orbit you're inside the Earth's protective shield most of the time. Okay, you're not above the atmosphere is not above you, it's beneath you, but the Earth's magnetic field still shields you from a lot of dangerous particles. And so in low Earth orbit, the sort of altitudes the space shuttle or the International Space Station operate at, we don't really need to worry too much about space weather. Having said that, you will pick up a higher radiation dosage than you would on the ground at Earth. But then again, that's true in aircraft. When you fly in an airliner at 10,000 metres, 30,000 feet, you're picking up more radiation than you would on the ground simply because you're above the really thick part of the atmosphere. So yeah, you have to keep an eye on those radiation effects. And I think in the International Space Station, when they know that space weather is particularly bad, or the space station travels through regions over the Earth where the magnetic field actually starts to funnel material inwards a little bit. So there's a region over the South Atlantic called the South Atlantic Anomaly, which actually the radiation dosages over that are a bit higher, simply because the Earth's magnetic field isn't perfectly symmetric. And so the space shuttle, the International Space Station were to fly through that, the astronauts can go to those modules which basically have thicker walls and more shielding. And so this kind of thing carries on most of the time. But if you're wanting to go further out into space, then you really need to start worrying about space weather. The Apollo astronauts picked up kind of reasonably high radiation doses compared to what someone on the street would. But still, they were, you know, measured in sort of numbers of CT scans or X-rays, so nothing too bad. And that was because most of the time, they were travelling quite quickly, so they were only in space for a few days, really. And most of the time, you're just lucky. Most of the time, the sun isn't firing out these big bursts of radiation, and so you can dodge them. However, if you're going to try and fly to Mars in the future, and that takes 6 months flight time, then you're pretty almost certain to catch some radiation. So really, what you're probably going to have to do there is start thinking about design of your spacecraft that will shield the astronauts sufficiently to keep them alive all the way to Mars and back.
But is it such that once you are at Mars, you would then be protected by Mars's magnetic field?
Well, sadly not, because as I said a few moments ago, the Earth has a double-layer magnetic field. It has an atmosphere protected by a magnetic field. On Mars, the magnetic field died out probably about 4 billion years ago. So Mars and the Earth started off looking kind of similar, but the dynamo mechanism, the liquid core of nickel and iron at the centre of Mars, wasn't big enough to hold on to its heat, and so the heat's escaped. It's a really simple bit of physics. If you imagine a bathtub of hot water and you scoop out a mug of water, the bathtub stays hot long after the mug has cooled down. It's all just due to the volume of heat in the material. Well, Mars has cooled down like that. It's much smaller than the Earth. Its magnetic field has switched off, so it doesn't have that shield. And so once its magnetic field switched off, its atmosphere was open to attack from the solar wind, and the atmosphere has been stripped off. So Mars has neither the magnetic field or the atmosphere. So the radiation environment on the surface is quite high because the atmosphere is so thin. So it's probably likely that the astronauts, if you sent astronauts to colonise Mars, they'd probably have to build their habitats probably underground. So you bury them under a few metres of the regolith of the soil, and that would give you some shielding. But out on the surface, they'd be exposed to more radiation than you would here on the surface of the Earth.
So if you were talking about terraforming Mars, you'd have to basically make it bigger.
Well, you could try and terraform. I mean, if you can do things in the atmosphere, that would help. So the atmosphere has lost a lot of its heat, but if you could thicken the atmosphere with carbon dioxide and other greenhouse gases, you could start to trap some of the heat again. So, but again, the atmosphere, you know, any atmosphere you build is going to get stripped away slowly. The stripping away process is pretty slow, though. So it's taken about 4 billion years for Mars to get where it is today. So who knows, perhaps human engineers would figure out a way to thicken the atmosphere quicker than it was being depleted.
Yeah, we're doing a good job here.
We're doing a good job on Earth. Yeah. Or you might decide that you want to build little shelters. You might build magnetic shelters on the surface of Mars to build little mini magnetospheres. So you'd have regions perhaps a few hundred metres or a few kilometres across, shielded by their own mini magnetosphere, like we have that surrounds our entire planet here at Earth.
There was a question you were asked yesterday. I hate to ask it. The Van Allen belt. The Apollo astronauts went through it. Some scientists talk about it being really difficult to get through, if not impossible. How do you square those two things?
So the radiation belts, they kind of sit, there's two, there's an inner and outer belt. And if you imagine there's almost as like big donuts surrounding the Earth, around the equator. And so in those belts, radiation is, particularly electrically charged particles from the solar wind, are trapped by the Earth's magnetic field. So actually it's a bit funny, it's this thing that gives us a shield, also does a good job of trapping some radiation. And so if you were to be orbiting the Earth at a distance that sat inside one of those radiation belts all the time, you'd start hooking up quite a lot of radiation, you'd be picking up a lot of radiation damage. However, if you're, for example, going to the moon, certainly in the Apollo program, the astronauts started off in quite a low Earth orbit inside the radiation belts, and then they went on a translunar injection. So basically they fire their rocket motor to speed up and slingshot out, and they actually cut through the radiation belts quite quickly because they're cutting through them. They're relatively thin, so you can cut through them quite rapidly. And sure, the astronauts will have picked up a radiation dose. But looking at all the measurements that came back from the radiation monitors on board the Apollo program, and to be honest with you, doing some A-level maths and physics, you can pretty easily see that the radiation dose isn't that bad. Sure, you wouldn't want it every day, but if it's, you know, that's what you need to do to get to the moon, that's what you need to do.
if you're talking about life on other planets, there are planets here which I believe inside the Goldilocks zone is Earth. Mars and Venus sit within it, but only one of them seems like it has life on it. Is that a concern for you if you're worried about finding life on other planets?
I'm a space physicist and I'm a bit obsessed by space weather and the aurora, so my answer is a little bit biased. But I would say, as well as finding planets in the Goldilocks zone, which tells you you have the right temperatures for liquid water, really, you really probably want to be looking for planets with a strong magnetic field. So that strong magnetic field will, like Earth, shield the atmosphere, shield the surface from radiation, basically, from particles from the sun. And I suspect that's probably what you need for life to evolve, and for exactly the same reason. It looks like complex life hasn't evolved on Mars, or if there is life, it was very simple, and it probably isn't there now, because the environment became unsustainable because of the loss of the magnetic field and the loss of the atmosphere. So we probably want to be looking for those telltale signs of magnetic fields and atmospheres. Now, I'm not an astronomer. I'm a bit myopic in my vision. I stay inside the solar system. But I would say that one of the things you probably want to be looking for are those signs of auroral light, of the northern lights, if you like, on those planets that have strong magnetic fields and atmospheres. Those could be the telltale signs of an environment that you know, supports life, because it's got that strong magnetic field and it's got an atmosphere.
What are your highlights of the festival?
Well, it was really great to come and talk on the mission control stage. I always really enjoy it. It's brilliant to see a tent absolutely full of people who are really keen to find out more. So, yeah, like-minded people who are wandering around, who are clearly very interested in science, clearly interested in space as well, and astronomy. So I really like it. It's a lovely place, a lovely vibe. Also, big fan of public service broadcasting. They do a great few tracks about the Apollo mission, and they did an amazing set last night, and myself and my little girl were rocking away to that, so that was absolutely brilliant.
Indeed it was. Really, really wonderful. And don't forget that we spoke to Jay Wilgoose of Public Service Broadcasting ahead of the festival, and you can hear that episode of The Cosmic Shed back in the archive on thecosmicshed.com. As anybody who's been near me in recent years knows, I am incredibly excited about the James Webb Space Telescope. So I was delighted to bump into Dr. Stephen Wilkins at Blue Dot. Stephen and his team are going to be some of the first people to use the Webb Telescope when it's launched, and they have a deeply wonderful plan for it. Fans of the Hubble Deep Field should stay tuned. But I began by asking him if James Webb will be the new Hubble.
It's not going to do exactly what Hubble's going to do, but I think we kind of like to use the term scientific successor. So it's going to be answering the questions that maybe Hubble didn't get the opportunity to answer because it was too small, but then opening up new questions. So the main difference between Hubble and Webb is that Hubble really concentrated on visible light. It could do a bit of infrared and a bit of UV, but it was really about the visible light. Whereas Webb is just dedicated to the infrared. So there's many reasons why you want to do that. Partly so you can actually push further back in the universe's history. So doing the same kind of science that Hubble did, but really far back in the universe's history. And that should be just because of the concept of redshift. So the further we look back, the higher the redshift objects are. So the more their light is pushed into the infrared. But there's a whole lot of other reasons to actually use the infrared as well. For example, we know that stars and planets, they form out of these clouds of dust and gas. Now that dust and gas is actually opaque to visible light. So you can see all these beautiful pictures that Hubble took, like the Pillars of Creation, probably my favourite and one of the most iconic. In those pillars, you really don't see the stars forming because you just see the gas and dust. Now as you look in the infrared, the infrared light can actually travel through that gas and dust, and so you can actually see now where the stars and planets are forming. So that's one of the other good reasons. Another good reason is people who want to look at atmospheres on planets around other stars. Now, first of all, the contrast between the planet and the star is actually, you have the best contrast when you look in the infrared. But also in the infrared, there are all these features which tell you about what the atmospheres contain. So for example, by looking in the infrared, you can say whether the atmosphere contains water or ozone or methane, all these kind of important molecules that we know maybe are going to tell us about life.
And So one of the most wonderful things about Hubble, right, is these incredible images. So we're not going to be getting those images.
So we will. So we will get very similar images. They won't be true colour, though. And in fact, lots of Hubble's images weren't actually true colour. Webb will actually give us images of a higher resolution, just probing kind of different things. So we will make these spectacular images like of the Pillars of Creation. They will look different. They will be higher resolution, so you'll see more detail. But yeah, we will be able to make just as nice pictures. But they won't be what you would see with your own eyes, which I know is a little bit of a disconnect.
Yeah.
But still, many of the things that many of the images from Hubble aren't really truly what you would exactly see with your own eyes, just because Hubble extends beyond what we can see with our own eyes anyway.
So if you had control, are you ever going to get control of
it? I do, yeah. So my team, we're part of a large international team. There's basically 12 of us. And so we're actually going to be one of the first groups actually using the telescope. So we got we won basically time through this program called the Early Release Science. So we're basically testing the telescope for science. And so the thing that we're going to do, we care about the very distant universe. So we're going to recreate something like the Hubble Ultra Deep Field. So a relatively blank patch of sky. We're going to image it with all the different cameras, all the different ways of using the cameras really to test things. We will push the frontier, so even with a relatively small amount of time compared to what's been put into Hubble, because the sensitivity is so much better, we'll be able to push to much higher redshifts, so much earlier in the universe's history. So we're just really going to start scraping the surface of what Webb will eventually do. So Webb will build upon our program with lots of other programs in the future that we'll hopefully be involved in as well. But there's colleagues all over the UK and across the world who will do all the different little bit of science as well.
So when is it going to happen, man? Because there's been some delays.
Yeah, so obviously, I mean, it's been delayed by 2 years in the last 6 months, which is not a good sign. The most recent delay came basically after this very long investigation that we hope was kind of... We think this investigation has been very thorough and it's now identified the challenges. And so NASA are now quoting something like 80% chance of flying in March 2021. Now, in that same document, and this is a public document, they actually list how long it would take, how long the mission would be delayed if they had to fix various issues. And so it could be pushed by a year, it could be pushed by further. But, I mean, fingers crossed for 2021... obviously it's not going to be before that now, but hopefully it's not going to be too much delayed. We are getting closer though.
Yeah. Right, because when Hubble went up, it needed to be fixed after it went up, and that, as a result of that they made that incredible IMAX movie.
Yeah.
So I reckon just get it up there and then fix it.
The problem with Webb though is that you can't fix it because it's not going to be in orbit around the Earth, so this is one of the major issues. So Webb actually is going to orbit the Sun, and so it's actually about four or five times the distance of the Moon away. And so it's, at the moment, it's impractical to actually send a manned mission up there to fix it. So unlike Hubble, we're not going to be able to send all these servicing missions. And that, unfortunately, kind of limits Webb's lifetime to maybe 10, 15 years at most.
Why?
So because Webb actually has some fuel on board, which allows it to move around and basically keep its orbit stable, that fuel will run out over time. Not to mention the fact that over that time, the instruments will degrade, the mirrors might get hit by... basically small chunks of rock, and so we don't really expect the entire telescope, let alone the fuel, to last much beyond that.
Okay, I mean, I'll be honest, my head is thinking of the Danny Boyle film Sunshine, right?
Mm-hmm.
We can send people into the heart of the sun.
I think that film is my least favourite science fiction film of all time because it's the least accurate. So it's kind of on there was another film called The Core, which is like equally bad science, although I think Sunshine just made it worse. That whole film, I always make fun of it because it's essentially Apocalypse Now in space. And Apocalypse Now is based on a novel called Heart of Darkness, and it's basically the exact same thing. They go and they find a crazy person who has been influenced by the environment that he's in, and now in Sunshine it was the middle of the sun, implausibly.
Yeah.
But in all seriousness aside, one possible saving grace for the more distant future, so maybe 10 years away, is the fact that certainly the US, in terms of NASA, they're pushing, or at least there's political pressure, to have a Mars mission, so a manned Mars mission. And it turns out, if you want to do a manned Mars mission, the first step would be to go to the second Lagrange point, which is where Webb is. So it might be that they do a test manned mission to L2, so well beyond the moon, and while they're there, they could, you know, fix Webb, refuel it, and then come back again, and then they go out for a longer mission to Mars. So it might be an excuse doing this testing there to actually fix Hubble, fix Webb. That's a long time in the future, and this is all very speculative at the moment, but there's a possibility.
Well, if James Cameron or Danny Boyle or any other film directors are listening, there's your next story.
Exactly, yeah. And if Elon Musk is listening, if you can just lend us a couple of quid, that might be quite useful as well.
You've begged a question in there, because you've told us what your least favourite science fiction films of all time are, so what are your most favourite?
2001. I mean, it is a classic movie. It's very slow compared to movies these days, but given that it was made 50 years ago, how many things they get right, and how many kind of, just the idea of artificial intelligence 50 years ago and it going wrong, this is still stuff we're talking about today. People are still making movies with the exact same plot device. And so I think 2001 is fantastic. I mean, I remember when I was 11, I watched Alien for the first time as well, and that got me interested in science fiction. At the time, I was terrified. When I watched it a few months ago as part of this series of films, the special effects are so bad, I hadn't realised, because I haven't seen it on a big screen since then. Yeah. But maybe it's because I'd seen it already, but the chestbuster scene was just silly. I mean, there are more recent films, like Moon by Duncan Jones, I thought was fantastic. And so there was a few things like that. But obviously, science fiction TV series, I've been able to explore a lot more these days. So I think because you've got a much longer period of time to explore some of these concepts, I think, the science fiction TV series is where I kind of care about it these days.
So are you watching what, The Expanse?
Exactly, that's the one that I was going to say. So I read all the novels already. I love The Expanse because it starts off as very hard sci-fi, so it makes me happy as a scientist, where they're doing everything kind of properly. I won't ruin the other books in the TV series, but it doesn't stay that way. opens up a bit more. So yeah, things like The Expanse were fantastic, yeah. Awesome. And going back, Battlestar Galactica was fun as well. And, yeah.
Brilliant. Thank you so much.
Yes.
There were film screenings at Blue Dot, including The Theory of Everything and Moon, but they clashed with public service broadcasting and The Flaming Lips, so I didn't see them again. Obviously, I'm not complaining. Clashes are inevitable at festivals, particularly ones so packed with fascinating and wonderful things. In fact, the only complaint I heard on site, aside from the obviously ridiculous festival prices in the on-site shop, was that some of the talks were impossible to get into due to large crowds. There's really only one solution to that. Bigger tents. But seriously, how brilliant is that? A music festival where the science talks are oversubscribed. It's not just astrophysics and astronomy at Blue Dot, though. And I had some really great conversations about climate science, but I'm putting those on the Physics World podcast, which will be out in August, all about driving in the future. But on a bench beneath the awesome piece of engineering that is the Lovell telescope, I caught up with an old friend.
I'm Laura Holland. I'm head of comms at the Rosalind Franklin Institute. Rosalind Franklin Institute's brand new. It's a new government-funded institute, and we are there to do just what Rosalind Franklin did, which was take amazing technology and completely revolutionise life science with it. So she took X-ray crystallography, which was a technique from the physical sciences, and using that technique, she helped Watson and Crick, and I'll use the word helped carefully. Her results were used to help Watson and Crick deduce the structure of DNA. So that iconic double helical structure, that came from a physical science technique, that came from technology in the physical sciences. So that what we would like to do is take technology, take physical sciences advances, and turn them into amazing technologies for life science. So to help make better drugs quicker, to help see further into the cell than we've ever seen before, to watch molecules move in real time. All of that amazing stuff requires technology, and we would like to build it.
And so you're a physical entity, you have a place.
We will have a place. At the minute we're at one of those trendy hub and spoke models, so we've got 10 university partners across the UK, so we've got scientists in all of these universities thinking about the technologies we need to build, working with people from their colleagues from academia and from industry to come up with the ideas. In the meantime, we're building an amazing new lab at the Harwell campus, which will be next to Diamond Light Source, next to the Central Laser Facility, next to all of the space technology clusters that they have there. So loads of fantastic physical science and technology expertise there. It's going to be a wonderful four-story building devoted to the technologies that we're building and making in the universities around the UK right now.
Awesome. When?
It'll open in 2020. So if you come to Harwell from about November onwards, there'll be a wonderful building site to look at. But come about the middle of 2020, you can come and have a look around the Institute and see all of the fab stuff that we'll be doing there.
Right. Now, you personally moved to that from Diamond Light Source.
I did.
So yeah. will the scientists at Rosalind Franklin be using Diamond Light Source?
Yes, they will. So particularly in structural biology, so if you're looking at proteins, so the structures of life, most scientists will use X-rays to do that. So they're using Diamond Light Source or other synchrotrons around the world to do that, because you need that really powerful light to see these structures carefully. One of our big areas of work will be helping scientists make those proteins into the crystals we need to examine them, because diamond is amazing. It's really highly automated, it's high throughput, but the work that goes on further down the chain to build the samples is actually still very manual. I think I've heard it described as a cottage industry. So if you can bring that automation and that technology to every stage of the process, you could speed it up massively, and it would give far better insight into the real world of the cell. So it all links up really closely to the big national facilities.
So if I was a scientist and I wanted to get involved in this, could I?
Yes, you absolutely could. So at the moment, we've got what we call theme leads. We've got some academics who it's their job to talk to other scientists. So if you are excited about structural biology, about looking at proteins, biological mass spectroscopy, so measuring proteins in other ways, generating drugs, if you're interested in microscopy, so correlated imaging, electron microscopy, if you're interested in imaging with sound and light, come and talk to our theme leads and get involved that way, because we're absolutely at the stage where we want to hear ideas, we want to hear about the technologies that would change your field, the missing step, the gaps, the technological gaps that need to be filled. That's what we're there for, so come and talk to us.
Awesome. Now, we're sitting on a bench.
We are. Under a wonderful thing.
Yeah. The Lovell Space Telescope, let's call it. Is it a space telescope? It's not really, is it? It's a telescope that looks into space.
I'm a biologist. It's a thing.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. It's a really big thing.
A big thing.
So is this festival. Now, you've done this sort of thing at lots of different festivals.
Yes, we have, yeah.
How does this one compare?
I adore this one. I think the Venn diagram of people who are genuinely excited about science, genuinely excited about music, it meets here. And that produces a lot of joy. It's a really positive, lovely, fantastic atmosphere. And it feels kind of productive. It feels like people are actively wanting to learn and wanting to change behaviours and have a great weekend. So, yeah, I love it. I love it very much.
It does feel like that, because obviously I've done a few of these things as well, and it feels like one where it's not about getting people interested in science.
No,
it's about taking them that step further.
Yeah, it is. It is. And it feels productive. You know, people are trying to take things away that they didn't have before, and they're actively seeking that, and it's really lovely. And that I particularly like, I think this year they're doing it really well, that celebration of the creativity of science as well, that the beautiful parts of science that often get overlooked are really celebrated here, and I think that's fantastic.
Any musical highlights for you?
We had a bit of a pre-chat about this, but the beautiful Wayne Coyne riding on his unicorn, that stays with you, that stuff.
Aside from their performance on the main stage, the Flaming Lips frontman Wayne Coyne also took part in a wonderful conversation with the director of the festival and associate director of Jodrell Bank itself, Professor Tim O'Brien. It was as haphazard and delightful as you can possibly imagine. I also promised to bring you Maddie. And Maddie took time out from her stand, talking science, to meet Tim O'Brien with me. Back in her undergraduate years, in fact, Tim was Maddie's first year physics lecturer.
First of all, congratulations on another wonderful festival.
Thank you very much. It feels a bit tiring at the moment, but we're enjoying it.
I was just watching Professor Monica Grady talking about the search for extraterrestrial intelligence, and she was interrupted only briefly by the Radiophonic Workshop playing the Doctor Who theme tune on the main stage. Yesterday I saw you, a professor of astrophysics, talking to Wayne Coyne and yes. Rockstar. I don't think there's another festival like this.
It does sound unusual, doesn't it? I mean, if you're going to have your talk about aliens interrupted by anything, it ought to be the Doctor Who theme tune, aren't it? But no, I mean, talking with Wayne Coyne was an experience I won't forget. I mean, Flaming Lips are brilliant, and I've met Wayne before because they played here in 2011, so 7 years ago, and he was lovely then. Actually, we took him around the control room and stuff, so I knew he would be a nice person to talk to. But you know, you're sort of a bit nervous. You're thinking, what do I ask a rock star about? And like, you know, so I'd prepared some questions, but to be honest, I only got through a fraction of what I was gonna, because he can just, you know, he would just talk about anything, and it was. I really enjoyed it. It was great. I think from what I hear, the audience enjoyed it too, so that's good.
No, I mean, yes, I'm sitting in the audience, and I don't want to compliment you too much, but it was a really magical thing. You know, you don't see that. You don't see astrophysics professors and rock stars on the same stage having a conversation.
Yeah.
And it was beautiful. Really, really, really wonderful thing. Yeah. So thank you for doing it.
No, that's all right. The thing is, when he came round in last time they were here, we were chatting about all these sorts of things anyway, you see, and then when we persuaded them to come back again, and it was like, oh, maybe he'll actually do an in-conversation thing. So I wrote him a letter and sent it through, and he says, yeah, fine, great. So there we go. It was an experience. I think they filmed it. I might get a chance to watch it back. I can vaguely remember what we said, but it sort of went all over the shop, didn't it? So
When you're doing that on stage, does that, are you kind of lost in the moment, or can you get a sense of what's going on?
You do, but you never. I mean, maybe it's just me personally. I'm never very aware of how it comes across to the audience. You're sort of aware of. I mean, there's lots of things going on inside your head while your mouth is talking, and there's words coming out your mouth. There's things happening inside your head where you're thinking about what you might want to say or whatever. And so sometimes it can be a bit of a blur. And especially because it's, you know, the adrenaline's up and stuff, isn't it? And you can't quite remember how it went. You can tell from the audience reaction. Usually can tell whether people are paying attention.
Yeah.
And then you get the responses. And you know, I'm on a winner with Wayne. I mean, like, he's used to being on a stage and he's used to getting audience attention and reaction, so that's fair enough. And I just have to sort of get in his slipstream, and we were away. So.
Well, you say that, but you are taking to the main stage here more regularly than he does, and speaking for longer than he does. Is that something you considered earlier in your career you might be doing?
No. I was saying to. In fact, I was telling my daughter about this the other day, actually, because she's just graduated, and I was sort of congratulating her on how well she'd done and stuff, and I was saying, well, you know, you're far more capable of talking to people than I was at your age. And I remember I did my PhD, and then I got a sort of temporary lectureship in Preston at what was Lancashire Polytechnic then, University of Central Lancashire now. And I can remember, even, you know, partway through a lectureship there, which is my first job, if I was late for a meeting, I wouldn't go in. I couldn't go in the room because I was so shy. And if I opened the door, I knew everybody would turn around and look at me. It was painful, you know. And so the idea that I would ever step onto a stage in front of thousands of people and talk about stuff would be just, like, ridiculous. But I like talking to people, and I like giving talks, I like doing lectures at the university and things like that, so I suppose you learn some things in doing that, but it's like, I don't know, it's just stepping off the edge of a cliff or something. You just sort of say, oh, stuff it, I'll just go and do it and see what happens. And I've never had anybody bottle me off the stage yet, so I shouldn't say that because I'm on stage tomorrow, so there's always going to be a first for everything.
You won't go out before then. No one will be like, So how did the festival kind of come to be then? You know, there's kind of a stereotype of scientists being a bit more shy, less forthcoming.
Yeah.
How did the science and music come together?
It came out of working with Teresa Anderson, who I'm married to. We are a couple. Teresa runs the Discovery Centre here, so we worked on the project to build these buildings that opened in 2011, and we were, you know, we do a whole range of sort of public engagement with science projects, or public talks, and we have schools visiting and so on. So all that sort of stuff you might say was like the meet and drink of sort of
public engagement and outreach work. But we wanted to, we were aware that we only ever reach a certain fraction of the population by doing that. You basically reach the people typically who probably already have some interest, who are going to be prepared to come to a talk, or you know, it's a school audience that are brought by the teacher or whatever. And there's a vast, actually probably the majority of people out there, they might not even have ever heard of Jodrell Bank and certainly have no idea what we do. And so this idea of having a reaching out beyond the sort of confines of science to a different audience, so people who might be interested in music or art or literature or whatever, we thought was quite an interesting one, that you sort of bring people in and they maybe they're attracted by coming to listen to the Chemical Brothers or the Flaming Lips, but in fact while they're there, they experience some science as well. And we very strongly feel that science is a really integral part of our culture, just as much as any of these other things are. You know, it's at the heart of modern life, and we wanted to sort of emphasise that and bring all these things together and sort of demonstrate that, I don't know, scientists are real people, normal people like everybody else, mostly. So, you know, you can... And it's just, you know, the name, I guess the name comes from, it comes from Carl Sagan's Pale Blue Dot, and the idea was, it's about the planet, it's about the people on the planet, it's about celebrating human creativity in all its forms, it's about looking after the planet, and it's about the exploration of space, all these sorts of things sort of coming together and creating something unique, I hope.
I think it definitely is. I mean, you do get science at other festivals, but I don't know of another festival where science is at the same level as the music.
Yeah, no, we absolutely wanted it to be, you know, at the same level, and that's why I, you know, that's one reason why I've always done these science from the stage as well. So the main stage, you know, you would probably reserve for the bands, and these other activities go on in other tents and things dotted around. But we thought, well, actually, yeah, we've got to have the other tents. There's got to be multiple venues. Well, let's do some science from the stage as well. Let's give it that. That place. And yeah, we did that first in 2011 with the Flaming Lips. So I went on stage and played the sounds of pulsars, and there's a dum 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 dum, and the clouds started clapping in time, and then there's the science chant, and it was like, and I was standing there thinking, oh right, I didn't expect that. maybe this works, maybe this is fun. And so we've grown it from there.
Was that your first foray into science music, or were you in a band or anything?
No, like I've never been in a band. Sadly, I never. I mean, I can't play it. I do a lot of sounds from space stuff. So I've got a record out. It's working with two record producers. So I sort of make music from space sounds, from data basically. So you take data and transform it into a sound. And if you work with clever record producers who know how to turn that into a piece of music, then it works. But I've never learned personally to play musical instruments. I can do all the computing stuff.
So you're a DJ.
So effectively, something along those lines. Yeah. No.
Professor,
so it's
DJ.
Yeah. We had a 7-inch picture disc. It was called Hello Moon, and it's on O-Genesis Records. The picture disc was the moon. So on the A side, it's got the near side of the moon, and on the B side, when you turn it over, you get the far side of the moon. Lovely picture.
Does it still exist?
It does still exist. It might even be available in the Jodrell Bank shop. I'm not sure.
Let's cut this interview now. I'm gonna buy it.
You can get it on Spotify. If you just have a look on Spotify, you can search for me on. It's Hello Moon, Can You Hear Me? By Professor Tim O'Brien, Jim Spencer and Dave Toland.
That's amazing. I'm really sorry.
And in fact, we're premiering a new track tomorrow.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
Well, we'll be on that on the way home.
Right, so let's talk about some science.
Yeah.
So since you did the Blue Dot last time, we've entered a new era of multi-messenger astronomy. Mm-hmm. Is Jodrell Bank going to have a part to play in that?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we're in a number of ways. I mean, multi-messenger is basically all it's saying is getting different types of signals from space. So we have, you know, the electromagnetic radiation, you know, and Jodrell Bank was at the forefront of moving beyond the visible to the invisible universe, looking at radio waves. But in fact, Jodrell Bank is only here because Bernard Lovell was interested in cosmic rays. So they're particles that come from outer space. So we have that historical involvement. But right now what we're doing is looking at basically at gravitational waves. So although most of our activity here is involved in radio astronomy, many of us work right the way across the spectrum. But in particular, we've got gravitational waves such as using pulsars. So we look at these sort of regularly flashing cosmic objects all around the sky. And as these long, very long wavelength gravitational waves pass through, which we think will come from the collisions of supermassive black holes, and when two galaxies collide, they produce these very long wavelength waves. When you look around the sky, because a large region of space-time is being expanded and contracted, you would see the pulses change period. So the pitch of the pulsar would change as you look in different directions. And so that's a big project we've been running for some years now, gathering data. And we've also got colleagues here working on neutrino detection. It's really exciting, and it's a totally new window on the universe. So there's great things to look for in the next decade or so, I guess, with this stuff.
So that level, yeah. Dish over there, listen, I don't want this question to come out the wrong way, but do we actually need it anymore?
We do. I mean, it's a good, it's a sensible question to ask. I mean, it's, 61 years old now? So it's, you might think it was getting to the end of its days. In fact, it's more capable than it ever was, because it's on its third surface. So we've constantly been able to upgrade the paraboloidal shape of the dish, which makes it more powerful. But we've also been able to upgrade the receivers. So the things at the focus that turn the radio waves into an electrical signal, they're far better than they ever were. They pick up a wider part of the spectrum. They're cooled down to just above absolute zero, so we can detect very weak signals. And the back-end stuff, the supercomputers and things that we use to analyse the data, of course, are changing all the time. So that telescope, although it looks, much the same as it always did, it's actually more capable than it ever has been. And there's still a role to play for these big dishes, albeit we now link ourselves up with many other telescopes around across the country, in the Merlin network across Europe, in the European VLBI network, and also in the global arrays. So we're not just focused on the Lovell. We've actually got lots of telescopes we use, but it still has a major role. Third biggest steerable telescope in the world still.
Yeah.
61 years later, so that's a big collecting area.
It's an awesome thing. When is it going to be moving again?
Right this minute it's parked, because we're doing two major jobs on it. You can see the two areas of scaffolding. Actually, there's one up near the top of the tower where we're doing some work on repainting that area of the top of the tower, and there's another scaffolding bit in the middle where we're replacing the whole of the original 957 surface, which is the bit you can see from below is the original surface. There's a new surface built above it, and that's now corroding away, so we have to do a like-for-like replacement of that, which is a massive job. That should be this summer and next summer. But in the winter we operate again. If we remove that scaffolding tower in the middle and the two areas of scaffolding there, we can tip and turn it just like normal. So it's not out of action permanently. We tend to do these big maintenance jobs that we do need to do to keep the telescope operating. We tend to do them in the summer because that's when you've got longer days, the weather's typically nicer. And some years it's something that stops us tipping, some years it's things where you can park during the day but you can operate a telescope overnight. Just depends on the details of the job. So
quite a lot of telescope upkeep then.
Yeah. No, it's the it does have to be looked after. I mean, we've got a big team of engineers so they inspect that telescope every day. So they go out on the telescope every single day, and they look for issues, basically. I mean, you get cracks in the steelwork, and we have to assess whether they're, how risky they are, whether they have to be fixed straight away or not. We had our first wheel break in 2007, so that was 50 years after the telescope was constructed. We had the first crack in it's basically a steel tyre on the wheel. So they lasted 50 years without a crack, so that wasn't bad going. The engineers are amazing. I mean, when it's operating, you can hear this. I mean, it's one of the beautiful things about working at Jodrell Bank. It's sitting in my office, but on a quiet evening, a lot of people have gone home. It's just quiet. The public have gone home, and all you hear are the birds tweeting, and then you hear this, which is the sound of the motors running up as the telescope turns to another object. But they can hear from the sound of the noises it's making whether it's operating normally. And if there's a problem with any of the gearing or whatever, they hear it from across the other side of the site, and they sort of come over and go, "There's a funny noise up there. I'm going to head up," and off they climb and find if there's an issue that needs to be fixed.
So does the festival interrupt the science in any significant way?
Yeah, I mean, you know, over the course of the weekend, there's so many people here and there's so much technology here. All that technology is producing radio waves, and that's really interfering with the radio astronomy. I mean, obviously, that as we sit here, the little telescope is parked with that maintenance work, so it's not observing. There is another big telescope at the far end of the site, south of the site, Mark II, that we are observing with, actually. You tend to get the more problems tend to happen when you're using a telescope on its own, what we call a single dish experiment. So, for example, looking at pulsars, where we don't need to zoom in to see structure, to see details, where they're basically a point source. They're so far away, they're a single small object so far away, you don't need to image it, you just collect the radio signal coming from it. Then you can do that with a single dish, and it's those that are most affected by the interference. If you start using these interferometers where the telescopes are spread over large distances, then if the interference is near one of them, when you combine the signal with the others, then that effect is largely cancelled out, not entirely. But because you've got these other telescopes at large distances that won't see that interference, then it's less of an impact. So we can continue with some science, but it's no denying that for the weekend there's a lot of interference which wouldn't normally be here. But we take that hit, I mean, for the benefit we think it brings to outreach and education and so on. We think for a few days a year it's worth the hit.
And next year, of course, is the 50th anniversary of the moon landing.
It is, yeah.
Can you tell us a little bit about the role that dish had in the Apollo moon landing?
Yeah, I mean, the Lovell itself, the Mark I telescope, it was called originally, was completed in 1957. And the very first thing it did was, with a radar fitted to it, it tracked the rocket that carried Sputnik 1 into space on October the 4th of 1957. So it's right there at the dawn of the space age, completely coincidentally. It wasn't supposed to be doing rockets and space stuff. That, no one really thought about that before then. It was supposed to be doing distant astronomy. But yeah, we tracked the rocket that carried Sputnik into space because it was a missile, because it was an intercontinental ballistic missile. So it's a defence reason. Could a telescope like that with a radar be used to give an early warning of missile attack by in that time the Soviet Union? But that basically led to us being involved in all that early space stuff. You know, track the first spacecraft ever to reach the moon, the first spacecraft ever to land on the moon and send back a photograph from its surface. And yeah, when it got to 1969, we used a small telescope, actually a 50-foot diameter telescope. That one's 250 foot in old money. We used a 50-foot telescope to track the Eagle lander onto the moon. So we usually pull out our little plot of the signal from the Eagle lander, particularly when we have moon landing loonies who don't use an inappropriate word, who don't believe we went to the moon, but it doesn't convince them because they just think we're part of the conspiracy. Yeah. Anyway, we did track the Eagle lander onto the moon with the 50-foot, but at the same time, and that was fun really, that was just to listen in and see what was going on. You can actually see in the signal where you see basically the Doppler shift of a signal, and so you see the relative motion of the Eagle lander and the telescope, and you can see where Neil Armstrong had to take manual control of the lander to fly it over a rough bit of ground to find a smooth bit to land on. And the trace sort of goes bumpy where he's basically flying this thing by hand, takes off the computer control, and then you see it go to a straight line when it at the instant it actually lands. But the big Lovell telescope was actually not tracking that, it was tracking the Russian spacecraft. So at the same, and it's a little known story, I think, that at the same time as Armstrong and Aldrin landed on the moon and were walking on the moon, there was a Russian spacecraft called Luna 15 that was also orbiting the moon, and it was a robotic mission, and it was designed to land and scoop up a sample of lunar soil and bring it back to Earth. It was a sample return mission, and so we tracked that, and while they were still on the moon, we tracked that Russian spacecraft as it crashed into the moon. So it failed and crashed into the moon, and I think, you know, that could have been so different, because there could have been a scenario where the Russian spacecraft successfully landed, successfully scooped up this sample of soil, brought it back to Earth. And it could have been, with the Americans, it could have been that the rocket motor that's supposed to launch them back off the moon failed. And Armstrong and Aldrin would have been left on the moon to die. The American president had his speech written, ready to announce that painful news. And it could have been so different, you know, as it was. Massive success, amazing. The Americans successful, the Russians failed. It could easily have been the other way around. But that's what we were doing in 1969, yes.
So that plot on the graph,
yeah,
is that the design of next year's Blue Dot T-shirt?
Ooh, well, it could be, couldn't it? Yeah, it could be. There's plenty of things we could be doing. I mean, we've started thinking a little bit about what we might do, but yeah, there's a lot more planning to do, I think. But it's going to be great. Of course, it's the weekend, you know, Blue Dot's going to be the weekend of the moon landing.
It's actually the weekend.
Yeah, and of course, the Saturday night of Blue Dot next weekend will be when they landed. So at 9:20 in the evening on Saturday night is when they landed. I mean, when they actually got out, and so the sort of Eagle has landed moment is bang in the evening of Blue Dot next year. The Smallest Step for Mankind bit is actually in the early hours, but we'll almost certainly be tracking all the activity of that mission in real time through the weekend in some way. Awesome. To celebrate that. So it's going to be great fun.
Yeah, we'll be here.
There'll be a lot of competition for the best event to be at for the 50th anniversary of Apollo 11. I can't imagine anywhere beating Blue Dot Festival for my affections, though. Although I do have two moon-based theatre shows, so I guess I'll just have to be wherever we're performing them, which could well be at Blue Dot. Are you listening, Tim?
Today is 13 October, Manchester Tracking Station. Time is 10:06. 10:06. I've had nothing which looks like any transmission from the rocket.
The Cosmic Shed.
Science fact.
Science fiction.
And everything in between.